Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour. This is David Corey, along with my co-host, Richard Hurley. Thanks for joining us tonight. Richard, how are you tonight?
Good, David. How are you doing? Good evening to all our listeners. We have another informative program tonight as we discuss many important issues for you veterans.
Absolutely. Tonight we're planning on discussing a number of issues. We're going to continue our discussion about the need to reform the VA and some ideas on how to go about doing that. We're also going to talk about the importance of veterans being heard, making their voices heard by the President, Congress, and the VA as this new administration and this new Congress get to work. We're also going to discuss information to help veterans with their disability claims, including using a concept known as individual unemployability. You'll find out what important concept that is. In our new Veterans History segment, we're going to pay tribute tonight to the Marines who served at Montford Point, North Carolina during World War II. And in our final segment tonight called Hurley's Tips, Richard Hurley will share some very practical, useful information for veterans who are dealing with the VA.
But let's start with the big topic of the never-ending reforming the VA. This past Thursday, leaders from the VA St. Petersburg Regional Office and the VA Medical Center in St. Petersburg held a town hall meeting for veterans and their families to voice their concerns about the VA. They certainly got an earful of complaints, including long waits for care and getting their prescriptions, bureaucratic runaround when they called the VA to try to resolve problems, and a totally broken VA disability claims system, something David and I have seen now over the last number of years. What was probably most shocking was a statement by the VA Regional Office Director, Juliana Bohr, who admitted the appeal system is broken and that if things aren't done to fix it, the wait time may double or even triple. That's shocking because as things are right now, the first stage of appeals usually takes 2 to 3 years at a minimum, and the stage after the Board of Veterans Appeals process takes another 3 to 4 years. This problem needs to be addressed by the new administration and by Congress, but so far it is unclear what the Trump administration's specific plans will be. What is their direction? Will they hire more people? Will they reorganize the VA's management and allocation of personnel? As you know, there's currently a hiring freeze. How will that affect the VA at this time? Will they try to revamp the appeal system itself? Will they try to get veterans to give up some of their existing procedural rights in the appeals process? You know, veterans already give up enough of their rights. Are they going to ask for more, such as allowing additional evidence at the decision review officer and Board of the Veteran Appeals stages? The answer to those questions and others remain to be seen. Therefore, it is particularly important for veterans to pay close attention to what is going on in Washington. David, what are some other things which veterans can be doing?
Richard, there are actually many things which we encourage veterans to be doing. First, pay attention to the news. I know that sounds obvious, but it's certainly the least one can do. And follow what Congress is doing, particularly in the House and the Senate committees on Veterans Affairs. Those are the committees that first consider proposed legislation, and they hold hearings on proposed changes to the law. And in addition to that, track what the VA is doing, not only through its press releases, which you can find on its va.gov website, but also through its proposed and final regulatory actions. Remember, Congress passes laws that are subject to the President either signing or vetoing, possibly overriding a veto, and the VA, which is a regulatory agency, has certain powers given to it by Congress to enact regulations which have the force of law. Now, those proposed regulations have to first be published in a document called the Federal Register, which you can access online. And the VA must allow a public comment period and then consider those public comments before deciding on the final version of the regulation. Now, we saw that in the last few months when the VA finally got around to proposing regulations for the veterans who had served at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and had been affected by the contaminated, the toxic drinking water. As you may recall, Secretary Bob McDonnell at that time, a year ago December, had issued a press release saying that they were going to create some presumptions for those veterans for their claims. But it wasn't until this past September of 2016 where the VA finally issued in the Federal Register their proposed regulation, giving a month public comment period, and it was just a couple weeks ago on the 13th of this month that the final regulations were published to be effective in early March. That's just one example. The VA is frequently proposing changes to the regulations, so it's important to keep up with those, but it's very easy to do that. You can sign up online and get emails, as I do almost every day, on those topics. Now, of course, beyond that, you can also track what major veteran groups like the National Veterans Legal Service Program is doing. That large organization, which has been around for decades, will sometimes challenge regulations in court, perhaps for, let's say, exceeding VA's authority given to them by Congress or some other legal reason. And they may file class action lawsuits on behalf of veterans, which they have successfully done many times over the decades. So that's the class action lawsuits are more of a strategic approach than fighting battles on just a case-by-case basis, which we've seen. Richard, what are some other things from your experience that veterans perhaps can do?
Well, you know, David, a lot of the stuff that we're bringing up to people, and especially for veterans, it sounds pretty complicated. And in a lot of respects, it kind of is complicated. But, you know, if you can utilize the Internet, you can track a lot of this online. There are websites for Congress and their committees. There's the Federal Register and the Code of Federal Regulations. And then there's the organizations such as the one you mentioned, the National Veterans Legal Services Program. And then a lot of veterans are members of various groups such as American Legion, Disabled American Veterans, AMVETS. And you have, most of my clients are go down to these organizations daily. Either for social or they actually work there and do some community service. But there's a lot of information that's going around these buildings that can be helpful to veterans who want to get involved with the situation in D.C., but then also get involved with what's going down at the regional office in St. Petersburg. It's very important, and I hate to tell veterans, they're fighting for their claims, David, and now we're asking them to fight, to put up another fight. And for a lot of these veterans, I had one to come in today, and, we've been working on his case since 2012, and he's had diabetes since 1987. He's an American Vietnam War veteran, and since 1987, when his diabetes took hold, his condition has just gotten worse. And he's still not set 100%. He virtually is in a wheelchair, uses a special vehicle to get around. And, for me to tell him, hey, we need you to put up some more fighting in. I don't know if these guys still have the fight in them. But we have to. We've got to change the system, not just for the veterans today, but this is a generational thing. I've always said in wherever I speak that, we're trying to change the current VA today, but we really need to start changing it for the veterans that are coming along 10 years from now, 20 years from now, because, we've got young veterans coming out of Iraq, Afghanistan, and who knows if we end up in any more conflicts. So, this is an ongoing process. It's been going on since 1921, and we have to get smart and do something about it.
Right. Well, I would also add that that's one of the major missions of this radio program that we have, which is to get the word out. We have an hour a week to do that, and we're going to offer as much information as we can, keep people current, up to speed with changes that we're aware of, and ways to remind people of ways they can get involved. Certainly, a lot of veterans may not have the time or the energy or the inclination to do some of the things that we're suggesting, but it is very important. And I'd like to talk more about, you know, the role of Congress, because we've got new Congress and a new president, and we'll be talking more in this hour about some of the ideas which were kicked around by Congress in the last session, which just ended before the November elections. And, of course, the Senate is soon going to be considering President Trump's nominee to be the new VA Secretary, Dr. David Shulkin. We discussed Dr. Shulkin's record and some of his ideas to some extent on last week's show. And so the question facing a lot of veterans now is, what can veterans be doing now to try to influence Congress, which in turn can help Dr. Shulkin and the VA better serve veterans and future generations of veterans? What might be some ideas, Richard?
Well, you know, one of the groups that I think has a little bit of influence, and who I think Trump is actually listening to, is the Concerned Veterans for America. I know you and I have talked about them before, and I think they came out in support of Dr. Shulkin. That might be one avenue to get in touch with them. And as I said before, you know, there are websites for the House and Senate Committees on Veteran Affairs. You can find them by the website is house.gov and senate.gov, and click on the committee. Both committees have contact information where you can send messages to the websites to members of the committee. Let them know of your experiences and what you expect from the VA, both in terms of health care as well as benefits and reforming the broken appeal system. You know, share your ideas. On those websites, look to see who's on the committee and contact the individual members. Down here in Florida, we have Congressman Bill Arrakis, who's up north of Tampa. And he's number two man on the Veterans Committee. So if you have, if he's your congressman, get in touch with him. Talk to his secretary. A lot of these congressmen have veterans working for them, whose job is specifically to handle complaints from veterans. See what legislation is pending. Right now, neither committee has posted much as far as upcoming legislation or their plans for this next year in Congress, but much remains to be seen. Probably as they wait to see what the Trump administration is going to support or oppose in terms of VA reform. And I'm sure a lot of that's going to come from Dr. Shulkin. So get your ideas over to Dr. Shulkin. You know, one of the things, David, you and I have talked about, and I know I've brought up many times, is that the VA, you know, we have all these different groups out there, be it Concerned Veterans for America, Wounded Warriors, all sorts of different, Afghanistan Veterans of America, Vietnam Veterans of America. So we've got all these splinter groups.
Right.
But there's really no one voice. I think until we get that one voice, you know, the people need to really do what they're doing right now in D.C. and all over the country, you know? Rise up a little bit.
Right.
Burn the wire. Burn the internet wire. But you know, let your opinions be counted and let them know you're out here. I mean, because, you know, we're in the trenches. Dave and I are in the trenches every day with the veterans. So we see on a first-come, first-served basis. And,
right.
It's pretty hard sometimes to see what these men and women go through and the walls that they have to overcome. It's frustrating for me. I can't even imagine what it's like for them on a day-to-day basis.
Right. As I've said before on other shows, this whole culture with the VA would be intolerable in the military if the military or even organizations within the military function the way the VA does. People would be fired. They would have been fired a long time ago, and drastic changes would have been made, to fix those particular problems. But it comes down to leadership, and it comes down to the people. You know, this big system and, you know, 2,000 pages of statutes and regulations, which is ridiculously complicated, These things don't execute, you know, these programs by themselves. They require people. They require judgments about allocation of resources. As you mentioned earlier, what's going to happen in the new administration? Are they going to be willing to hire more people despite the recent freeze by President Trump on federal government employees? How are they going to reorganize the VA, or are they simply going to deal with the claims and the appeals backlog by trying to limit veterans' rights? These are all really important questions, and they're going to affect cases that exist now. They're going to affect years into the future, and it's very important. And veterans, to the extent that they're able to, they really need to get involved. It may seem like we're asking a lot of them, but it's to benefit themselves and other veterans. Now, you mentioned some other questions about, you know, what will be the solutions? Will there be proposed legislation to revamp the appeals process? Will veterans be possibly losing some of their rights? We'll discuss more of that, but that's a very serious concern of mine. You know, as I mentioned earlier, as far as hiring more people for the VA is, by its own statistics, is short somewhere in the ballpark of about 45,000 employees, and a large percentage of their management, more than 40% of their senior officials, are currently eligible for retirement. You know, at what point are they going to say, just throw in the towel and retire, and will there be people prepared to step into their shoes? These are all things that we're going to see in the next few years.
But David, we don't have that 45. You know, the approximate number. We don't know if that's on the medical side or the comp side or.
Well, you know, it's a combination. That particular one is a common. I think most of those are on the health care side, but certainly there is the need, whether they've identified positions as being open or not. I think most people would agree that there's certainly room for or the need for hiring a lot more people on the benefit side, on the disability compensation appeal side, because otherwise, how are they possibly going to deal with a current backlog of in excess of 450,000 cases which are on appeal? And, you know, you mentioned in our opening a few minutes ago how the director of the St. Petersburg Regional Office, Juliana Board, who in a town hall meeting just this past week over in St. Petersburg, said that people, she admitted the system is broken unless there are changes, which she didn't elaborate on, then veterans can expect the waiting time to double or triple. And she's not the only one saying that. I mean, I've done a lot of research of what members of Congress have said and indicated as some of the reasons for reforming the system, and there have been other members of Congress that have said the same thing. And what the VA is projecting, I don't know whether these numbers are correct or not, but they're projecting, you know, that in the next 10 years, what's a backlog of 450,000 appeals cases may escalate to over 1 million cases, which would explain why they also project doubling the appeals time. So the VA may propose and try to put pressure on Congress to change the laws restricting appeals, restricting, limiting the VA's duty to assist these veterans. And
well, you know, David, personally, you know, I was on the civil side for 25 years plus before I started representing veterans. And I was a former president of the County Bar Association. I was an officer in all the different chairs and committees. And, you know, we always dealt with a civil backlog and a family court backlog and a criminal court backlog. And rather than restrict the rights of these litigants, which is what you're kind of suggesting about Congress, you know, limiting the veterans' rights to due process.
Well, I'm not suggesting that's a good thing. I'm just saying.
I know. But what I'm saying is there are ways that, and this is where that Juliana Bohr kind of ticks me off, because, you know, instead of offering some solutions, such as a mediation system. You know, I mean, you know, I know it would take some time to work it out, but, you know, don't just get up there and say, you know, the system's broke and it's going to be double or triple down the road. You know, that's why my client walked into my office today and I said to him, what kind of solutions do you think the Trump administration is going to have? And he said, they're just going to wait for me to die, Mr. Hurley.
Right.
I mean, you know, that's the attitude out there.
Right.
So let's offer,
right. Well, that's what one of the people at the town hall, she said that's the perception out there, that the VA's standard procedure is to delay, deny, and wait for people to die. And that's not just a saying. I mean, the VA, by its own admission, in less than the last 8 years, more than 32,000 veterans have died while their cases were waiting a decision on appeal. These are 32,000 individuals whose lives were affected, and they were probably waiting years even before that point. So
and,
the system and does need to be changed.
What our listeners need to know is that in some cases, if the veteran has a spouse, then he or she can substitute in as the claimant for the veteran. But in those cases where there is no spouse, the case is over. And,
right.
And the VA saves that money. That money never gets paid out.
Right. Well, there are also exceptions for dependent children and also to pay for any expenses of the last sickness or funeral expenses. But that's a pittance compared to what the veteran deserved or as when he or she was alive. I'd like to take a few minutes and discuss in more detail one of the proposals which passed the House of Representatives this past fall.
David?
Yes?
Before you do that, let's put that number out there. In the U.S. and Canada, if you'd like to call the show, call 1-888-627-6008. That's 1-888-627-6008. We'd love to hear from you.
Yes, that we definitely would. We'd like to know your thoughts on what might be some solutions. One solution that passed the House of Representatives by a pretty commanding margin last September was a bill called the VA Accountability First and Appeals Modernization Act of 2016. It covered, like a lot of congressional bills, it was pretty lengthy. It covered a lot of different subjects. But the one I'd like to talk about specifically was how it would change the review of VA claims that had been initially denied. And let me give you some background first about it. The way the system has been created for decades and existed for decades is it's not supposed to be an adversarial system. And veterans should not have to have lawyers. Historically, there have been veterans groups with veteran service officers, trained individuals, knowledgeable about the claims process, to help veterans. They leave the service and they file these claims. And because it's not supposed to be adversarial, there's a duty under both the statute and regulations that the VA is supposed to assist veterans in developing, gathering the evidence, and telling the veteran what they need in order for their claim to be granted. But historically, that's been a duty that the VA has done a rather poor job on. They may make efforts to get some medical records, and the information they give to veterans about what they need to prevail in their case is very general, very basic, very skeletal kind of information. It's really not case-specific. So what you have are these veterans, and I'm giving more of the background here, most veterans use these veteran service officers or file their own claims, and they themselves put blind faith in the VA to assist them. So the VA does a poor job. What happens? Service connection issues are denied, or the VA issues what the veteran believes is an unfairly low rating, which translates into less money. All right? So that's where we see a lot of problems. So then they get a decision, a denial, or a low rating, and they want to appeal it. Well, this proposed legislation, which actually passed the House of Representatives, it was introduced by the former representative of the state of Florida, Jeff Miller, who just left Congress. He's been the chairman of the House Veteran Affairs Committee. He had a lot of clout. But this proposal, which passed the House, then it passed the Senate, would have changed that to basically say that once the VA makes its initial decision, the VA no longer has a duty to assist. And furthermore, in order to encourage veterans who wanted their claims, their appeals, to be moved along faster than they are, which is already incredibly slow, that they were going to, if they wanted to ask for a review official to have what's known as a de novo or a fresh look at it, they would then give up their rights to submit new and additional evidence. Now, the law did, at least according to the committee's press release, I think the language of the law is actually different. The press release said that, well, the veterans could still submit new information if they asked for a hearing. Well, that doesn't solve the problem. Richard, you and I know it takes 2 or 3 years to get a hearing at the initial level, and then another 3 or 4 with the BVA. So this proposed law was basically taking away rights. It was diminishing, lessening the VA's duty right when the veteran may need it the most. So I think it was an incredibly bad proposal, and unfortunately, from what I've read, a lot of veteran groups were neutral on it or somewhat supportive of the whole package because a lot of the rest of the law dealt with holding VA employees accountable. So that's the sort of thing I think people need to be attentive to, because the bottom line is, in my mind, there is no doubt that such a proposal will make it tougher for the veterans to win their cases and much tougher to win on appeals with probably no perceptible increase in the processing time. In other words, no benefit in speeding things up. So it's we really have to keep our eye, even on Congress, these veteran committee members who may talk up a good story for supporting the veterans. You have to watch what they're supporting, because they're also factoring in what the VA wants to do, and the VA, unfortunately, is not always that sympathetic. What are your thoughts, Richard?
Well, it's clear that it's been difficult for Congress to enact any meaningful reform measures into law, and I guess it remains to be seen what will happen in the coming year with the new secretary and the Trump administration. Looks like a lot could go on, or you know something, nothing may happen, and we just may end up with the same situation that we've had over the last decades. But now let's move on to other topics for tonight. And one of the most important issues we see in the VA disability arena is a fair disability rating for disabled veterans. The VA has a complicated and very detailed set of criteria for rating literally hundreds of physical and mental conditions, practically every condition you can imagine which might be service-related. What surprises many veterans is that when they have multiple disabilities, the VA does not simply add up all of the ratings for a final score. They use what they call the combined ratings table. We like to refer to this as VA math. So 1 plus 1 equals 2, but in the VA system, 1 plus 1 might equal 1. Under the combined ratings table, a veteran's multiple disabilities, in effect, overlap each other to some extent. For example, a veteran with 3 disabilities, let's say rated at 30, and then another one at 20, and then another one at 10, if you added up those numbers, you would think it would be 60. But in actuality, under the combined rating table, section 4.25 of the federal code of regulations, it comes out to a 50. The combined ratings table makes it particularly difficult for a veteran with many low-rated disabilities from reaching a rating of 100%. We often say that getting a veteran from 0 to 80 or 90, I should say it this way, getting a veteran from 90 to 100 is as difficult as getting them from 0 to 80 or 90. We have a case right now where if you added up everything, all the veterans' disabilities, she's about around the 120 or 130. However, she's currently at 90 for purposes of the rating table. So it's a little misleading, and that's why, you know, one of the things that you and I, David, you and I have been using, and I think quite successfully, is the concept of total disability based on individual unemployability, also called TDIU or IU. And what happens there is when we get a veteran up in the 60 or 70 range, we can then apply for the IU claim to get them up to 100. So a veteran must have at least one service-connected disability rateable at 60% or more, or two or more service-connected disabilities, at least one disability rateable at 40% or more with a combined rating of 70% or more. If we have one of those two scenarios and the veteran is unemployable, then we can get that veteran up to 100%. The difference in income, or compensation, I should say, is anywhere from $1,300 to $1,500 a month. So that's something that veterans should always make sure that they talk to their representatives or their lawyer about, because it's a very artful way of getting you up to that 100%. And you, David, you were talking before about the duty to assist.
Right.
And you and I have seen in the past where a veteran might get a rating for PTSD of 70%. Now, with the duty to assist, since that veteran has a service-connected disability of 60% or more, the VA should take it upon themselves to put together the application for individual unemployability and have that heard, so that the veteran could then get up to the 100%. But in all the time I've been doing this, I've never seen once where the VA has taken upon themselves to assist the veteran to go from 70 to 100 using the concept of individual unemployability. In fact, we have cases where our veterans come to us and we're told by other veterans and even some employees over at the VA, don't push it. Be happy with your 70,
right?
Because if you seek the 100, the VA may turn that on you and decide to. And we've talked about this, about reduction of service connected disabilities, and say, well, we're going to reduce you from 70 to 50 now. So now that fear has been put into the veterans all over these different veterans organizations and even at the VA. But you know, if veterans are listening, don't listen to anybody. If you have a service-connected disability with rateable of 60% or more, or at least, or two or more service-connected disabilities, at least one disability rateable at 40 or more with a combined of 70, go and apply for the 100. If you can't get the service-connected disability up to 100, then go try to get the individual unemployability disability.
Right, and if I could add, Richard, there is a specific VA form which they have to fill out. It's a VA form 21-8940. That's the veteran's application for increased compensation based on unemployability. It's a very short form. It's only two pages, and most of it is devoted to the veteran reporting information about past employment history. But as you said, Richard, yes, it's getting to 100% is very important in terms of, you know, the finances. The difference between a 90% rating and 100% rating is about $1,200 per month. In other words, the difference between, for a single veteran without any children, a 90% rating is $1,748.71, and up to 100% is $2,900, just over $2,900 per month, a significant difference. So, yeah, we really want veterans to be aware of the individual unemployability concept, and in addition to the basic criteria that Richard has outlined, in some, although this is not frequently granted, there's even the possibility for what's called extra scheduler unemployability when they're really exceptional or unusual circumstances, like marked interference with employment or frequent periods of hospitalization, even though they might not meet the criteria of, you know, one disability at 60 or two or more with one at least at 40 with an overall at 70, those criteria. And so, but it's, the the bottom line is you have to be aware of the issue, and it's individual unemployability. So always keep that in mind if you have problems working and the schedule doesn't get you to 100%. So, Richard, what are some other topics
As you said earlier, we've got the history segment, and tonight I'd like to bring attention to the service group of a group of U.S. Marines during World War II who were discriminated against because they were African American. They served in the Marines at a time when many military leaders opposed having blacks in the military or in combat. They faced blatant discrimination, separate and unequal conditions in their training, living conditions, and opportunities. One group of Marines were called the Montford Point Marines, after the name of the segregated post in North Carolina near Camp Lejeune. In 2012, Congress passed a law awarding those Marines the Congressional Gold Medal to finally recognize their service during World War II, including not only their courage and sacrifice, but having done so in the face of grossly unfair treatment based on their race. Of the 19,000 Marines who went through training at Montford Point, just a few hundred are still alive today. Today, we remember those Marines. If you'd like more information on the Montford Point Marines, you may find it interesting to check out the website, montfordpointmarines.com.
Thank you, Richard. That's a great tribute to our fellow veterans. It's important that we remember history, and in our upcoming shows, we will highlight the service of other veterans across the generations and up to the present generation who has just served our country and are serving our country in our most recent and continuing wars. Richard, let's talk more about information that may be helpful in a practical way to veterans who have disability claims and appeals.
Well, that brings me to Hurley's Tips. And tonight's topic is about the VA forms known as the Disability Benefits Questionnaires. These are very, very good what we call DBQs, and the information on these DBQs can be essential in assisting a veteran in the processing of his or her VA claim. And they have DBQs, I think there's about 70 or so DBQs out there, and they cover a wide range of medical conditions. Now, the DBQ itself was put together by the VA. So this is technically their form. And whenever I've had veterans take a DBQ to their examination at the VA, more likely than not, the examiner says, we're not allowed to fill those out. And my client says, well, but these are your forms. What do you mean you're not allowed to fill them out? But the reality is that the VA does have these forms on their computer, and they just fill them out on the computer. But if you're litigating a disability claim, you can take these DBQs to your private care doctor, orthopedic, psychologist, for if it's an anxiety, depression, PTSD type of claim. And, you know, they got them for shoulder and neck and knees and ankles and feet. And take them to your doctor and have them fill it out. But it's very important that when you fill them out, that you have the doctor fill them out completely. There's a whole bunch of boxes and spots to check and places to write in. And a lot of doctors, they don't like, they do their examination and try to get you out the door. And when you put this DBQ in front of them and say, you know, my lawyer needs to fill this out, sometimes you have to go back a second or a third time, and generally speaking, what I found is he passes it off to his nurse or assistant, and they kind of fill it out for the doctor. But however it gets filled out, I know, David, you and I have found them to be extremely useful, especially in our PTSD cases. We have a psychologist that we use that's terrific. I mean, he doesn't leave a space on his DBQs. He writes in everything.
Right. He does a much more thorough job, we found, than the VA psychologist or psychiatrist. And his thoroughness is reflected in his reports, which his thoroughness then you know, makes it very, very difficult for the VA to rebut his report because he takes the time. He'll have the veteran in for multiple appointments, make sure he knows the full history, does testing, et cetera. Richard, I'd like to mention a few other points about these disability benefit questionnaires. We sometimes get the question from veterans, well, will the VA pay for a private doctor to fill out the DBQ or any travel costs for the veteran to get the DBQ completed by the private doctor? The unfortunate answer is no. And that it says so right at the top of each DBQ. It's an expense that unfortunately the benefit the veteran may have to bear, but in most cases, it's still worth trying. We've had many doctors that have filled out these DBQs with no additional charge or just for a very minor charge. Of course, there are some experts out there that will charge a significant amount of money, but it's always best, we found, to ask if the veteran is going to a private medical provider, to ask them if they'll fill it out. And it's important that the veteran, and may require the assistance of the representative, to make sure that the doctor has all the relevant medical records if the doctor doesn't have that already, and as well as a copy of the veteran's disability claims file. Some of the more recently produced VA forms in the top section of the first page will ask the doctor to indicate which records have been reviewed, both medical records as well as claims records. So the more information that the doctor has, the more persuasive that doctor's opinion will be. So very practical advice about DBQs, as Richard has said, but they have to be legible. You know, some doctors will handwrite these things, and you can't make any sense of what they're writing. You know, and sometimes they will simply not fill out the forms completely. They're in a hurry, and some of the questions on these forms will have multiple subparts. It might be if you answered yes to this question, then you have to answer the following or provide some rationale. And some doctors just don't take the time. Unfortunately, that's very frustrating to the veterans because we have to send the DBQs back to the doctor or perhaps find a different doctor to do that. The whole idea behind the DBQs originally was to help reduce the claim processing time. I'm not sure it's really done that, but in some cases it has. But overall, we still see claims taking too long, and particularly if the VA still requires the veteran to go to a compensation and pension exam, which is the VA's kind of official version of a DBQ. Now, one thing I'd also point out is that the VA has taken the position that there are no disability benefit questionnaires for certain medical exams, and these are set out on the VA's website. They include things like the initial exam for post-traumatic stress disorder, the initial, I emphasize, rather than any a subsequent review, hearing loss, tinnitus, and tinnitus, residuals of traumatic brain injury, cold injury residuals, prisoner of war exam protocol, Gulf War medical exam, and a general medical exam for both compensation and non-service-connected pension purposes. Let me talk about cold weather residuals because we've had a couple cases recently, including one that's on appeal right now that involves that. And what happened was the veteran who had served in Alaska and suffered some cold weather injuries that affect him to this day, he filed his claim, and this was before he hired us. He went to the VA's compensation and pension exam, and the doctor did an incredibly superficial exam and didn't even follow the VA's protocol. There's no DBQ that he could take to his private doctor, but what I did was I used the VA's own internal protocol and had the private doctor use that in lieu of a published DBQ and to essentially rebut, because the private doctor's report was much more thorough than the VA's doctor. And the case is on appeal. We'll see how it ends up, but I'm pretty confident about that. So the fact that there's not a DBQ, that's where good judgment and analysis of a particular case might offer some alternatives. As far as there being no DBQ for hearing loss and tinnitus, Well, that's true, but it hasn't stopped us from getting reports from private doctors, and there are some private doctors out there that have done a lot of hearing tests for veterans, and they even know the standard of proof that's applicable to VA cases, which is 50-50 probability or greater, and some of them have their own form letters for that. So the point is, don't be deterred by the fact that you, a veteran, may have a condition for which there's not a DBQ. There's actually, as Richard said, there's 70 or more DBQs, and the VA is periodically updating them as the evaluation standards change over time. Richard, any other thoughts that you have or advice or tips about the DBQs?
No, not at this time, but, you know, I had a veteran come in today, and one of the things we talked about, which is something I think new on the horizon, at least it's not, you know, talked about as much, but it's similar to the Agent Orange and the Camp Lejeune, and that's the burn pit syndrome, which is really the result of the Gulf War II and Iraq and Afghanistan. And they're saying now it's becoming the next Agent Orange issue, as well as the Agent Orange. And a lot of veterans are coming back, and they're dying. And what a burn pit really is it's an area. Usually, sometimes it might be 10 acres in size, and anything that can be thrown away is thrown away, whether it's tires or vehicles or destroyed equipment. It includes hospital waste and also human waste. And they get thrown in these pits and set afire. And then veterans are, or military people are walking through this, and they're coming home extremely sick, coming back with sinus problems, eye problems, cold sweats, painful lymph nodes in grape-like clusters, tumors. And, you know, I think, David, this is going to be something that's going to be on the horizon for a lot of these veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right, and we saw some of that, too, from the first Gulf War, Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm, and we have some clients that served in that time frame. And you may remember the Iraqis set fire to a lot of oil fields, and there's photographs which you can find on the internet which show the sky completely darkened with smoke from these burning fields, that these veterans breathing in the smoke and being exposed, as you said, to the burn pits with all sorts of things. We've got some clients that served in Iraq, and what's interesting, you know, there was a big issue about whether or not the Iraqis had weapons of mass destruction as far as justifying the invasion in 2003, but there have been veterans that we know that have encountered munitions with chemical properties, chemical weapons, essentially, old shells, which we know for a fact that the Iraqis had used against their own people going back as far as the 1980s. And which were a huge concern during Desert Shield, Desert Storm, whether they would use them. And some of these old shells are still around, and veterans have inadvertently been exposed to them and handled them. So I completely agree with you. I think that what was for the Vietnam generation, the Agent Orange issue, we're going to see more in the next decade, a couple decades, with the Desert Shield, Desert Storm veterans, more of these mysterious ailments, and we're going to see even more of that with the latest generation who served a lot in Iraq and Afghanistan, exposed to all sorts of things and diseases and environmental problems in those countries. So what this does also points back to the earlier problem we were talking about, which is the backlog with the VA. Whether they're claims, but certainly on the appeal side. So there's going to be a big demand for VA healthcare services upcoming decades, and certainly the claim side, the appeal side, is going to continue. That's why I'm really concerned that I think if Congress does anything, and your point was a very excellent one a little while ago where you said Congress may not do anything at all. if you spend just a few hours researching, through congress.gov and see all the thousands of bills which are proposed, not just for veterans matters, but for every conceivable problem, or perceived problem, there are thousands of laws and only a tiny percentage ever actually become laws. And we see the same thing in the VA world on a smaller scale. So many ideas out there for reforming the VA, and very few of them actually become laws, which explains why we've had decades of the situation getting worse. Congress is essentially ineffective. The VA, with whatever resources it has, not enough resources. They've got morale problems, staffing problems. They've got mismanagement. They've even got some fraud, abuse, and corruption. It's a lot of different factors there. We're not pretending that there's easy solutions to it. The VA does do a lot of good things for veterans, but we want to serve as a watchdog with this radio show and get the word out to veterans. There is a whole lot of room for improvement.
Yep. And you bring up a good point. I'll hear from clients of mine who will say that John Doe, for instance, he got his claim right away, and he got to 100%. And I'm worse off than he is. And what I say to veterans, and I'll say tonight, is you can never compare your case to anyone else's, whether it's in the VA, whether it's a family law case or a criminal or a civil case. Every case has its own facts. And every case is adjudicated by different people. So unless we're going to go to a completely total uniform situation, which is not going to happen, you're going to have situations where you feel, meaning the veteran feels, that he's being picked on and that other people are getting their claims heard faster than theirs. And maybe so, but that's just because of the way the system is. I mean, David, we have a case right now. We're meeting with the client, and he got his Board of Veteran Appeals was certified back in October or November, and we got a hearing notice for him for February the 14th.
It's inexplicable because his case had not been advanced on the docket, and yet we've got other clients who've been waiting for years for the same thing, and it's not as if we've not rattled their cage in different ways to try to get the VA to move, but the system has got to be fixed. I think they have to hire more people, and they've got to better manage the resources that they have. I mean, there's just – otherwise, Julianne Bohr's prediction of doubling or tripling the waiting time is going to occur, and at that point there may not be the political interest to make even more drastic reform. Now, I see where we're running out of time tonight. I hope everyone has found this information useful. I want to, as we end the show, I want to remind listeners of something I mentioned last week, which is an important thing. If you know any veteran who is in a crisis of any kind or suicidal, the VA does have a crisis line for veterans to get help, and you may want to write this number down. Veterans Crisis Line is 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255, and then press 1. Many veterans, sadly, have committed suicide because they didn't get the help they needed from the VA. So help them get the care and the help they need to cope with their problems, and get the word out about the Veterans Crisis Line because it's there for a reason. To wrap up, I'd like to thank all of you for listening to our show here on BBS Radio. As you know, this is a weekly news and talk show about military veterans issues. We'll be here every Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain Time, and 8 and 6 p.m. Pacific Time on bbsradio.com, Station 1. We'd like to once again thank our producer at BBS Radio, Doug Newsom, for his great support and help, and we invite listeners to become show guests, sponsors, and advertisers. Call me, David Corey, at 813-662-0760, or Richard Hurley at 727-612-1515 if you're interested in being on the show. And That's our show for tonight. Everyone, thanks for tuning in, and hope to hear you next week.
Thanks, David.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on VBSRadio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.